Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I am welcoming back Kristen Stoltz-Presley, who has is the series editor for the series Essential Musicals from Methuen, imprint of Bloomsbury Publishing. And she was on a couple of weeks ago talking about Pulitzer Prize-winning musicals, and she's back this time to talk about Jukebox Musicals, the second book that she has authored in the series, of which there are more coming, as she's promised. Hi, Kristen.
Hey there. Thanks for having me back.
Welcome back. And this is going to be a fun episode because Jukebox Musicals are a very big topic of conversation.
To put it lightly.
a topic of conversation and of heated debate quite a
yes.
bit. People either love them or they hate them. There is a lot of debate as to what actually constitutes a jukebox musical, because I find that there's sort of like three categories of jukebox musicals. Mm-hmm. There's sort of like the revisal version of jukebox musicals where they take an old script and completely rework it and put in songs from that show as well as add other songs from that.
Yep.
And then you've got the bio musical where it's a specific performer, songwriter, whatever. It's a bio musical. And then you've got the one that's sort of like a real true jukebox musical where you're taking a collection of pop songs that were not theater songs to begin with, but pop songs, sometimes by the same composer, sometimes by the same artist, and you're shoving them into a completely new libretto story that has nothing to do with the artist, nothing to
That's
do
right.
with the songwriter. Mamma Mia being probably
That's
the
right.
prime example, which is the songs of ABBA shoved into a story that has nothing to do with ABBA. To me, those are kind of like the three categories. And some people
yeah.
are like, well, you know, you know, the Mamma Mia is like a true jukebox musical, but are bio musicals jukebox musicals? Are the revisals jukebox musicals? I don't know. So give us your concept of what a jukebox musical is.
Well, that's a big one.
I know.
I would say a jukebox musical is a musical that uses a catalog of music not written for musical theater mm-hmm. in order to tell a story as a musical, right? Mm-hmm. In the musical form. Now, that can be a bio musical, a la Jersey Boys. That can be a fantasy story that is created out of thin air, like Mamma Mia. Mm-hmm. I would not put reviews here, although certainly yeah. they do play like a jukebox musical. The difference between a review and a jukebox musical, for anyone who might be wondering, I would say is that a review doesn't have a plot. A review is just performance of songs. So Smokey Joe's Cafe, for instance, which was so popular in the 90s,
right?
Lieber and Stoller's music, it's great and it's awesome, but there's no plot to it. There's just a series of songs. So
right.
I wouldn't put that in this category at all. So there are some distinctions that need to be made, but by and large, I would say a catalog of music not written for musical theater is used to tell a story using a musical form.
Right.
And, but there are quibbles with that, I know.
Of course. Like I said,
hold it loosely.
Exactly. You have to.
Yes.
So, putting together this book for Essential Musicals, of jukebox musicals, what was the criteria that you used to get to your 10? Because you have to use only the limit. You're limited to 10.
That's
essential right. musical books are working as 10.
That's
how
right.
What was the criteria for you?
Length of run.
Uh-huh.
It ended up being very simple. And really, when I made the list of the ones that I wanted to talk about, they ended up being basically the same as the ones that had run the longest. Mm-hmm. So there were a few. I can't even honestly remember which of the ones that were left out, but none. I was very happy with the list. I felt like the list that remained based on the length of run on Broadway was representative of kind of the cream of the crop of mm-hmm. jukebox musicals. What was very important to me, however, was to establish that Mamma Mia was not the first. And so that's why I start with Crazy for You, because there's this notion that Mamma Mia was the first one and all of a sudden, boom, it's 25% of new musicals made or jukebox musicals. And that's not the case. This has happened on Broadway for a long time. In fact, historically, we can look back to the 18th century at John Gay's The Beggar's Opera and say, well, he was telling a story using folk music, songs that people in the audience or on the street would have known and could sing along with. Mm-hmm. So we can't say this is a brand new invention. And I wanted to make that point. And so that's why I start the timeline with Crazy for You in 1992. There's other reasons I started with Crazy for You that I can get into, but and I will later. But it was important to me to establish that this is not a new thing. This is not something that all of a sudden, you know, Bjorn Ulvaeus and Benny Andersson from ABBA wake up and decide, let's make a musical. That's right. Not at all how it happened.
Right.
So it was important to establish that. But beyond that, I just made a list of the most popular ones and ranked them in order of the length of their Broadway runs. That's another point to make about this whole series is while certainly a lot of the shows that we discuss have a life in the West End and have life on tour, our focus is on the Broadway development and on the Broadway run. And that was decided purely so that we have a common denominator, right? Mm-hmm. So that we're that's our baseline is Broadway. Now, in Rob's book, Queer Musicals, not all of those shows made it to Broadway. So there are some exceptions that we make where necessary. But by and large, if a musical has, you know, even Mamma Mia, for instance, it opens in the West End, but I can talk about the development there, but what I'm going to focus on is New York and when it ultimately got to Broadway.
Right.
So we're looking specifically at Broadway.
Well, let's start where you start, which is Crazy for You.
Yes.
Which sort of falls, I purposely picked three from the book.
Yeah.
And I purposely picked one from each of those categories that I talked about to kind of give samples of each of the categories. And Crazy for You sort of initially started life with the basis of the Gershwin musical Girl Crazy as the inspiration initially.
Yes.
But it does fall outside a little bit of the jukebox musical definition.
You're right about that.
In a sense, because the songs were written for musical
theater.
They
were written for musicals. Yep, you're right.
But it's tricky because, again, it's a completely rewritten book by Ken Ludwig, who was brought in, who's a master comedy writer.
Yeah.
Comes in, but talk a little bit about, real quickly, about the development of the show and how they pieced it together and why they pieced it together.
Yeah. And first, I want to say, just from a biographical note, my very first history of musical theater class at the University of Kentucky as a first year master's student, I was assigned a paper that was do a deep dive into the history of a musical. And I picked Crazy for You because at the moment, it was 2003, I was listening to Jody Benson sing those songs nonstop in my little Honda Accord and trying to sing just like her, obviously failing. But nevertheless, I loved that show. And so when I got the chance, I could have picked a number of shows, but I picked Crazy for You as that anchor point to show that Mamma Mia wasn't the first because of that strong, you know, that was the first time I really did this kind of work. So it was especially meaningful to me to choose Crazy for You because of that. But yeah, so it starts off with in Cincinnati in 1934, I believe, a young boy named Roger Horchow, who lives in Cincinnati with his family, is awakened one night because he hears piano being played in his downstairs. It wasn't all that unusual. His mom was a pianist, but he could tell by this playing that this was not his mother. And so he goes downstairs, and who is playing his family's piano but George Gershwin. Mm-hmm. Gershwin had been in Cincinnati that night for a concert, and his mother had invited people over to come, and including Gershwin, and Gershwin had come to meet him and to learn more about his work. And so that began a lifelong love affair of Roger Horchow with the work of George Gershwin. And he especially loved, like you mentioned, the musical Girl Crazy. And he determined early on in his life that he wanted to somehow produce a revival of Girl Crazy for Broadway, all owing to that one night. In his own biography, he had a very special connection to the Gershwin music. And as time went by, he makes a ton of money. He's a catalog guy. He works for Neiman Marcus as well as some other retailers, and then starts his own catalog company, the Horchow Collection, which is really, really popular. He sells it in the mid or like 87, maybe late 80s for like $117 million. So he has suddenly a lot of means. And the very first thing that he decides to do is to make his dream of producing Girl Crazy on Broadway come true. Now, in the mid-80s, he'd started doing micro-investments in shows like Les Mis. I think he invested in Secret Garden and Phantom of the Opera, a few, but micro-investments, a couple $1,000s. Suddenly, he has $117 million to play with, and he can make his dream come true at that point, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he sets out to do that. The problem is, when he looked at the script for Girl Crazy, and even more so when the director that he brought on, Mike Ockrent, and the librettist, Ken Ludwig, whom you mentioned, when he brought them on, they read the libretto for Girl Crazy, and were like, nope, not going to work. You know? We've come too far, right?
Right.
As you can imagine, those librettos from the 30s were not ideal. Yeah.
They were kind of silly comedy sketches, all yes. just basically to get to the next song.
And that's right.
They were very
right.
simple. They were very simplified stories.
They were. And they also had a lot of material that would be considered deeply offensive by yes. modern audiences.
Yes.
And so, you know, it had to be, the book had to be completely overhauled. Well, when they realize we're going to completely overhaul the book, they think, well, what about music? Why can't we just overhaul the music? And so they ended up plugging in songs that had not come from that show, but were from the Gershwin catalog. And while they're in the development for the show, there's this whole trove of music that is discovered in a warehouse in New Jersey, of all things. And there's untold, unsung, unheard Gershwin music in there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so they're able to pull in some new music, music that came from other musicals, as well as music that was originally in Girl Crazy. And then, you know, the end result is Crazy for You, which premieres on Broadway in 1992.
Blues. The critics called it a joke song, but now they change the tune and they like it somehow. For it's inoculated with a syncopated sort of meter, sweeter than a classic strain. Boy, you can't remain still and quiet, or it's a riot. The real American folk song is like the fountain of youth. You taste and it elates you and then invigorates you. The real American folk song, master stroke song, is a rag. The real American folk song is like the fountain of youth. You taste
one of the things I also wanted to note, because it's the success of another musical that was also kind of a revival.
Yes.
Was so instrumental to this happening, because this was, I have to remind people that in the late 80s, it was sort of the time of the big British invasion.
Mega musical pop operas
like Phantom and Les Mis, and then Miss Saigon. But the success of the British import of Me and My Girl.
That's right. That's right.
And Horchow saw that show and said, oh my God, this is a, because it was, that was a 1930s musical from
England
that was revived.
That's right.
And the success of that show in England and on Broadway showed him that there was an audience for that kind of show.
Yeah,
and that
absolutely.
Kind of also helped spur what ultimately became Crazy for You. Plus the fact that the director of that show was Mike Ockrent.
That's right.
That's why he hired Mike Ockrent, because if he could guide me and my girl to the stage, he could certainly handle the girl Crazy for You. And Mike Ockrent was also... It was also instrumental in them finding Susan Stroman,
yes.
the choreographer, that she then became the future wife of Mike Ockrent.
That's exactly right.
And it started kind of really launched her career.
Yes.
So Me and My Girl kind of triggered this whole string of events that led to Crazy for You becoming a success.
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you brought that up. Me and My Girl was a British musical, mm-hmm. and the heir of the guy who had written the music for that was noticing his royalties one day had jumped way up, you know, for this old song. He got his royalty statement. He was like, wow, what's going on? And he realized the power of nostalgia, right? Uh-huh. And realized that people were hungry for, the old things, the old music, the old stories, that sort of thing, and everything old is new again. And so he pursues this musical, and you're right, it was essential to the development of Crazy for You. And also you're right to point out that this was a moment, in fact, we see it in the reviews for Crazy for You, that the British mega musical had been dominant on Broadway by way of, you know, the Lloyd Webber musicals, as well as Les Mis, brought to us by mega producer Cameron McIntosh. So we have Evita, and then we have Cats and Starlight Express and Les Mis, and then we have Phantom of the Opera and Miss Saigon. That's the late 70s and the 80s. Those are the mega musicals. And so in the reviews, it's the point is made that when historians look back to see when the Americans took back control of the musical, they'll point to tonight when Crazy for You opens, because this is so American.
Right.
So it was a very important show beyond just having unbelievable music and being an absolutely breathtaking production with, yes, choreography from Susan Stroman that is unforgettable and so... emblematic of her style, you know, just mm-hmm. effervescent. So it was really important. Not only do I have an emotional attachment to it, but it was important in the development of, you know, or in the history of the musical.
Stiff upper lip, stout feather, carry on old stuff. Chin up, keep muddling through.
Stiff upper lip, stout fella, when the going's rough. Hip hip to old man trouble and a toodle-oo-too.
Carry on through thick and thin.
If you feel you're in the right,
let the fighting spirit win.
Fight, 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 fight.
Stiff up the lip, stout fella, when you're in a stew.
Sober or blotto, dicker your motto.
Keep muddling through.
Thank you.
So now we're going to turn our attention to one that falls squarely into the category that I think almost everybody agrees is a jukebox musical, because it's taking a list of pop songs or rock songs and placing it into a completely made up story.
That's right.
But it's not Mamma Mia.
Right.
And it's one that I think people are going to have forgotten even existed, but it's a show that ran 2,328 performances on Broadway. And when it opened, a lot of critics were basically, the critics actually loved this show. I mean, they got really good reviews. And many of them were saying, this could be the next Mamma Mia.
Yeah.
And at over 2,300 performances, it did really damn well on Broadway.
It did really well.
And we're talking about Rock of Ages.
Yes.
Which had the craziest beginnings. I mean, it had the beginnings are associated with the Pussycat Doll of all things. I mean, it's like, talk briefly about the history of Rock of Ages, because it was never meant for Broadway. It was never meant to be anywhere near, because it was meant for Vegas originally.
That's right. Vegas was the goal of Matthew Weaver, who was the guy who had the idea first, and the director, Kristen Hange, who is currently directing Romy and Michelle off Broadway. She was the one who insisted it belonged on Broadway, but we'll get there in a minute. But I do want to say, before I jump into Rock of Ages, I want to make a point about Mamma Mia. Though Mamma Mia was not the first jukebox musical by any stretch, it was the first one to make billions of dollars, right? And when creators saw the enormous success of Mamma Mia, suddenly anybody who had any kind of a catalog of music that they had written was thinking, can I make $1 billion with my music? You know what I mean? I think it was a wake-up call to anyone who had a big catalog of music. And so in that way, it did jumpstart the modern jukebox musical era, though it is not the first. And Rock of Ages comes after that point, when people are beginning to think, particularly producers are beginning to think about, what catalog of music can I use to create a show, right? Another thing that's at play here, and even more so more recently, is the expense of producing a Broadway show. And if you've got a known catalog, that kind of shortcuts the whole thing a little bit, right?
Right.
So there's some other economics at play that I won't get into, but I do want to make the point that Mamma Mia was not the first, but it was the first to be a $1 billion enterprise. And that causes all the heads who have, you know, that have lots of song catalogs floating around in them to say, wait a minute, I need to make $1 billion on this money.
And the stream is never ending. As you look every season since then.
That's right.
There's another catalog driven jukebox musical.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So at any rate, Rock of Ages. So Matthew Weaver is a guy who first had the idea, and his very small idea was, what if you had a musical that used the songs of the 80s and you could go listen to the songs of the 80s and get a drink? Period. End of story. Like, that was his idea. And it had kind of come to him because his wife was a producer, and he was watching his wife produce The Pussycat Dolls Live, directed by Kristen Hange, in Los Angeles at the Roxy. And so this is 2002, the year after Mamma Mia premieres, when everybody's starting to think about big catalog shows. And Hange, at the time that she's, you know, directing this piece, she notices all these old rockers come into the club, and they're telling her stories about, you know, the things that have happened to them when their band was playing this club, and the girls that they met, and the things that happened, and this and that and the other. There's all kinds of stories that happened. And that was, you know, she began to think, independently of Matthew Weaver's idea, she began to think, I think there could be something here. Like, all these old guys coming in and telling their stories about playing this club, I just think there could be something here. Well, then when Weaver has his big idea, and like I said, he's connected to Hange because his wife is producing that Pussycat Dolls Live at the Roxy show. Hange says, you know, I think there's something here, you know, using music of the 80s to tell the stories of these guys that I've been talking to as I'm directing this show, these old band guys coming in. I think that could be something. Well, Weaver, again, insists this is a Las Vegas show. He wants nothing to do with New York.
Uh-huh.
He wants it to play, you know, the bright lights of the Las Vegas Strip. And so, of course, they have to bring in a librettist. And so Angie is telling her manager or her agent about this. She's like, here's the idea. I don't know. And it has to be somebody who can write, but who understands the music of the 80s. And I don't know. And her agent says, well, wait a minute. I think we just signed that guy. And his name is Chris D'Arenzo. And so she sends over some scripts that Chris has written, and Kristen reads them, and the two of them meet, and it's like, okay, yeah, I think you are the guy to write this show. And so they get going. And the first step in the process was to do a 30-minute show at the King King Club in Los Angeles. And the hope for that was purely that they would get somebody from a casino to come and see the show and be interested enough to produce it in Las Vegas. That was the goal. End of story. So it was a 30-minute that little showcase at the King King Club, but it was really, really popular. They didn't have much luck with the Las Vegas idea, but they did have a lot of luck with audiences who were very energized by this show. And so they decide, let's do a full production. Let's see what happens. So in January of 2006, just a few months later, they open a full production of Rock of Ages at the Vanguard Club. Now, the Vanguard Club was a club after hours, but the show was renting it out kind of for that block of time mm-hmm. before it turned into a club each night. But it was not working well because they kept running over, and the club owners were not happy about it. They needed to turn things over so they could get the nightclub part going. So they moved the production of Rock of Ages to Ren Mar Studios, which had been a TV film studio. I Love Lucy had been filmed there, as had episodes of Seinfeld. Lots mm-hmm. of shows throughout the years had been filmed there, and it was now kind of a space for hire in 2006. And so they moved there in 2006. And again, audiences love it. They eat it up. It is so much fun. People are, as Matthew Weaver had dreamt of, they're coming and hearing those songs of the 80s, and they are having a drink and enjoying themselves, and it's awesome. Well, finally, a couple months later, May of 2006, Weaver gets his dream. His vision is realized. Finally, they're going to play the Las Vegas Strip. And they are the resident show for a two-week period, I believe, at the Flamingo Showroom at the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas. Well, it was not as warmly received.
No.
In fact, they compared it to like performing for the cast of Cocoon.
Right.
So it was, you know, audiences were older. They had not grown up in the 80s. They did not have the nostalgia for this music that you really have to have in order to go all in on Rock of Ages. Weaver himself was out in the streets, you know, passing out flyers, trying to get people to come in and see the show. And there were not many takers. And so they closed up shop there pretty soon, and they thought, well, that's it. It was a fun run. We did our best. We did, you know, a tremendous amount of work on this project in 2 years or whatever it was from start of the idea until May of 2006 when they played Vegas, and it just didn't work out.
Not really jealous, don't like looking like a clown. Thought of you every night.
Well, time goes by, and I mean a lot of time. And Kristen Hanji is out running, and she is listening to Whitesnake's Here I Go Again on My Own, and she's thinking of how much fun that project was and missing Rock of Ages days. And later that day, she gets a call from Matthew Weaver, who says, guess what? I think we might be able to take the show where? Off Broadway, mm-hmm. which is where Hanji had said it should be all along. And so they get the chance to go off Broadway. They open in October of 2008 at New York Stages. Reviews at that point were pretty tepid, but the audiences were crazy for this show. They absolutely love it. And so Weaver did something very unusual. He worked also as a film producer, and so he gave out tickets to some of his buddies in the film industry, and he created buzz for Rock of Ages by letting his buddies in the film industry get into a bidding war for the rights to the movie version of mm-hmm. Rock of Ages. And that generated enough buzz that suddenly, you know, they had the means to go to Broadway.
Right.
And so, and also working in their favor at that time was the economic downturn. There weren't a lot of shows. 2008, so there were a lot of theaters that were vacant. And Weaver goes to Niederlander, Jimmy Niederlander, and says, listen, I want to do this show. And he says, do you have the money? And Weaver said, yeah, I got the money. And he said, okay, give him the I think it was the Brooks Atkinson.
Yeah, Brooks Atkinson, yeah.
Yeah, give him the Brooks Atkinson. And so they opened the show there in March of 2009. And it runs, as you said, until I think January of 2015. It is a juggernaut. One of my favorite moments in the story of this one is New York Times critic Charles Isherwood comes opening night.
Yeah.
And then he does something highly unusual. The next day he calls and asks if he can come back. And, you know, Weaver finds out about this and he's like, oh, gosh, that is not, he wants to really give it to us, you know. But he knew everything was going to be OK when he saw Isherwood coming in the next night and he had a drink in his hand and he was sitting down and enjoying the show. And that's when Weaver knew, OK, Isherwood likes it. We're going to be OK. So, it, of course, became a huge hit, produced a film that was disappointing for many. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, the show itself was a big hit that more than recouped its $7 million investment.
How can I convince you what you see is real?
Blame you for doubting what you feel.
I was always reaching. You were just a girl I knew.
I took for granted the friend I had in you.
I was living for a dream, loving for a moment, taking on the just my style. Now I look into your eyes. I can see you forever. The search is over. You were with me all the while. I was living for a dream, loving for a moment, taking on.
Sort of fulfilled the predictions that it was going to be sort of the next Mamma Mia in the sense that it really ran.
It did.
And it made its money, man.
It did.
And it appealed to the audience.
Yep.
So
the power of nostalgia. I mean,
absolutely.
I think that can't be overlooked as you talk about the success of all of these shows is the power of nostalgia. And one thing critic, I believe Chris Jones, who writes for the, who wrote for a long time for the Chicago Tribune and now was writing in New York, wrote about the things that make a good jukebox musical. And one thing he mentioned was that you have to have the music sound like it sounds on the album. Mm-hmm. And there are some outliers for that, but for the most part, that rings true. The closer the music sounds to the music on the album, the more that nostalgia factor is at play. Yeah. If it sounds super different, then I don't even recognize that. That doesn't ring any bells for me. But if it sounds like the music I've been singing along to in my car since I was a teenager, that has an impact. Now, I mentioned outliers, one of them being Hell's Kitchen. Alicia Keys herself did some, and others, Tom Kitt was part of that music team too for Hell's Kitchen, but they played around with some orchestrations on her and some arrangements on her music, and it still played really successfully. But that's really the exception rather than the rule. It needs to sound like it sounds on the album.
Yeah, I think that's really right, because you're playing up with that nostalgia factor.
Exactly.
And the nostalgia,
exactly.
Part of the nostalgia is that it needs to sound very similar to the song that you people recognize.
Yep, absolutely.
And that's a perfect segue to the last of the three musicals.
Yeah.
Which is in the bio musical category. And it's the biography, sort of biography, of Carole King, called Beautiful, which initially she was reluctant because she didn't really want it to be solely her as the focus.
That's right. She did not.
Yeah.
She had started working as a teenager in New York, started writing very young, and wrote with her husband, started as a collaborator, became her husband, Jerry Goffin, and also worked with some very close friends, Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann. And they produced, I mean, just the soundtrack of the 1960s. I mean, it was just hit after hit after hit. And if you see Beautiful, the Carole King musical, then you know, I mean, they just kind of do a parade of hits. It's unbelievable. And then she and Jerry Goffin split up. His infidelity split them up in battles with mental health issues in the late 1960s. And she goes on to Los Angeles and writes singer-songwriter style albums, which is becoming all the rage in the early 1970s. And she writes, her second solo album is Tapestry, which is a genre-changing sort of album. I mean, it was on the New York Times bestseller list for like 6 years. It's just unbelievable, the success of that album. Mann and Weil, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, continued writing together until, I mean, I believe Cynthia just recently died. One of them just recently died. I believe it was Cynthia. But they continued writing together until the very end. And so when she was approached about doing a musical about her life, Carole King said, no, you can do it only if you make it about the four of us. It wasn't just me. It was the four of us. And there were a couple of reasons for that. One is she's naturally a very humble, self-effacing person who doesn't seek the spotlight. But two is, she didn't really want to watch her life and her personal biography with Jerry Goffin play out on stage, right? She wanted to, she didn't want to relive that. That was agonizingly painful. They had three daughters together. So you can imagine how difficult that would be to see that play out. And so she was not interested in that. Eventually, though, she was convinced that they could go on and that they could produce this musical. And so that happened. Her daughter kind of served as her proxy on the creative team. And there's a early production of the show plays in
San Francisco.
Yes,
I saw that tryout. Yes, I did.
How different was it? I didn't see it.
I do recall. And it was, I saw it kind of later in the run.
Okay.
So they had started making some of the changes.
Yeah,
they had made some of the changes. So it did include the tapestry stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
they had put that in. They had put that stuff in.
Yeah. Initially, they stopped because it was about the four of them. It was about Jerry Goffin and Carole King and Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. And when that all broke up in the 60s, that was the end of the musical initially.
Right.
And the feedback that they got in San Francisco was, that's great, but where's Tapestry? I mean, you cannot tell Carole King's story without telling Tapestry, right? Mm-hmm. You can't really tell the music or tell the story of rock music in this country without telling the story of Tapestry. And so, you know, they kind of had to go back back to the drawing board in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. and focus, largely the second act is focused on Carole King and her trajectory post that right. sort of her life writing in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And so they made those fixes, and then the show opens on Broadway. From the very beginning, Carole King was resistant to being involved. She attended an early workshop and left at the midway point, didn't want to see it, didn't want to. She said, I know what comes in the second act and I don't want to watch it. Mm-hmm. And so she left. She had never seen the show. She didn't see that San Francisco production. She hadn't seen it in a tryout on Broadway. She had not been to the Broadway opening night, though everybody else involved, including Jerry Goffin, was there. But she remained at arm's length when it opened in 2014 on Broadway. And then after about 3 months after it's running on Broadway, and it's not, you know, breaking any records by any stretch at this point, she decides she's going to go see it. She's ready. So she tells the producer, I'm coming to see it. She tells her daughter, I'm coming to see it. But those were the only people who knew. She shows up in a wig. Of course, Carole King has that iconic blonde curly hair. She shows up in a black or a brown straight wig and a trench coat. She really did not want to be seen here. But by the time, you know, the curtain comes down, she was so smitten with the show and completely in love with it. She sneaks onto the stage with the cast at the curtain call. They have no idea she's coming. You can see this moment on YouTube. It's absolutely beautiful. They start talking about Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS and raising money for that. And then Carole King's like, if you'll do $30,000, I'll play, you know, You've Got a Friend or something. I'll play the piano and sing with the cast here. And so that ends up happening. They raise $30,000 on the spot because Carole King is there. And then, of course, subsequently, she's become a huge champion of the musical. But initially, she was so resistant to it. I think what happens with a lot of these writers, a lot of these songwriters, rather, is, you know, they get to, Carole King was at an age when she thought she was going to retire. She was 70 years old. She'd just written her biography, her autobiography called A Natural Woman. And it came out, and suddenly the spotlight was on Carole King again. And that's when the idea for this musical starts to percolate. That's when she's awarded the Gershwin Prize for, you know, songwriting and her work in the arts, that sort of thing. And she said, "I've tried to retire, but I guess now is not the time," because all of these other projects kept coming her way, including Beautiful. But I do think that a lot of these artists who end up having jukebox musicals made with their catalogs of music, I think for a lot of them, it's about legacy. We know that to be the case with Neil Diamond. He was one of the most successful touring acts of all time. And then he's diagnosed in 2018 with Parkinson's disease, and he can no longer tour. And so he thinks, well, how else is my music going to persevere, right? And so he realizes this is a legacy moment. Tina Turner was the same way. When she was approached by Phyllida Lloyd, who directed Mamma Mia and then directed Tina, the Tina Turner musical, when she was approached by Phyllida Lloyd about having her life turned into a musical, Tina Turner said, absolutely not. But then when she started thinking about, but wait a minute, the things that I've overcome in my life can be an inspiration for other people to overcome them in their lives. And so I do think there is a legacy component here that becomes very important the older that these artists get. And I think that's one of the reasons why we see so many of the bio musicals.
Stayed in bed all morning just to pass the time. There's something wrong here, there can be no denying. One of us is changing, or maybe we just stop trying. And it's too late, baby, now it's too late. Though we really did try to make it. Something inside is dying and I can't hide it. I just can't fake it. Oh, no, no. It used to be so easy living here with you. You were light and breezy and I knew just what to do. Now you look so unhappy and I feel like
having now done the jukebox musical book,
yeah.
Were there any surprising stories about the seven shows that we didn't talk about? Or even better, Were there some other jukebox musicals that didn't make the final 10 that you have a soft spot for or
no.
are personal favorites?
There's really not. There's really not. I will say, I definitely enjoyed working more on the Pulitzer Prize winners because I know the players, right? The Pulitzer Prize winner, those shows are dealing with traditional musical theater players. Right. Jukebox musicals, I had to learn a lot about musicians that I really didn't know a whole lot about. So it was out of my wheelhouse. So it was tricky in that regard. I nevertheless enjoyed the process and certainly learned a lot and think there's a lot that we can learn about, you know, why is this genre so dominant on Broadway? But there's none that were left out that I'm like, daggone it, I wish I could have gotten that one in. There is one that has come out since this, not since the book.
Oh, I think I know which one you're going to say. Yeah.
Oh, is it Anne Juliet?
Yeah.
I think that story is fascinating.
Yeah.
So I would love to have dug into that one. I will say, though, as a historian, it is hard to write about stuff that is so close in time, in the rearview mirror. You know, like I'm writing about, I love MJ the musical, but writing about something that premiered on Broadway in 2022 is a lot more difficult than writing about something that premiered in 1931. And the reason for that is the historical record has changed so much. Like when I write about Of the I Sing and Pulitzer Prize winners, I can look at, I mentioned in the previous episode, all those New York newspapers. I can pull those all up on my computer and read them. Well, now we don't have that. We do have some newspapers, but not nearly as many. And so much of what we're preserving is done on social media. And that is a completely different beast. It's much harder to capture. It's much more subjective, subjective. So it's harder to write about things that are so close in the rearview mirror. I'd rather write about things at a distance because I can get a little bit more of context to them. So this was a difficult assignment for me for that reason, but there weren't any shows that I really wished that I could plug in there. Though I do now, I would love to dig into Anne Juliet. It just was, I was done with the book by the time it hit on Broadway. So it wasn't even a player. The only one that I was a little sad not to have was Ain't Too Proud. I do like that show a lot. Motown's in here, so they're similar. And Ain't Too Proud just barely missed the cutoff. But I think that's a really great show. And so I was sad to not include that one. But there really weren't any others that I was going
to make. Well, Kristen, I am so thrilled you're able to come back.
Thank you.
Talk about the Jukebox Musicals book, which is part of the Essential Musical series out from Methuen, which is part of Bloomsbury Publishing. So you can find, I will include links so you can find the books and you can find Kristen online. She's on Instagram and on Facebook, as well as she has her own website. So you'll be able to find her as well. And there are more Essential Musicals books coming. So that's good. So that'll be exciting to do. You know what the next titles are going to be?
I do.
Is there like an off-Broadway musical?
There is an off-Broadway coming. I tell you, things get tangled in my head between what's coming this year and what's coming next. But there's off-Broadway coming. There's revue musicals coming. There is coming-of-age musicals coming. So we've got
Was there a Black musicals?
Black musicals we have not yet commissioned.
Oh, okay.
But it is definitely on the list. As is musicals by women. I mean, there's a long list of musicals with religious themes. So looking at Godspell, et cetera, Joseph, that kind of thing. So there's a long list. But the ones that are currently working are Coming of Age, Revues, Off-Broadway. And there's one more that I am forgetting.
You just follow Kristen online and also check out her Dr. Broadway podcast.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, so they can follow her because she's got a podcast as well. So anyway, thank you again, Kristen. It's been a delight.
Well, thank you for having me and again for being so warm in your consideration of these books. I am so grateful. Thank you.